Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, and welcome to another edition of New Books in Systems and Cybernetics, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm your host, Tom Scholt, from the University of British Columbia. In the opening chapter of his edited volume, Social Systems and Design, out from Springer in 2014, Gary Metcalf asks if it is possible to establish ethical first principles for the design of social systems. Inspired by his mentor, Bela Banathy, a giant of the systems field, and pondering the potential levels of influence we might actually have over the evolutionary development of the social systems in which we are all embedded, Metcalf provocatively asks what sorts of goals we should set for ourselves and what sorts of means we should use to achieve them. In the subsequent 8 chapters, a host of systems thinking luminaries, including Alexander Christakis, Peter Jones, Marilyn Emery, Thomas Flanagan, and Raul Espejo of Project CyberSyn fame, offer probing and detailed contributions to the search for answers to these questions. Along the way, readers will gain an acquaintance with the concepts behind dialogical design science, co-laboratories of democracy, third phase science, open systems theory, and much more. This volume is a transdisciplinary feast of some of the most progressive thinking going on in the systems field regarding such issues as sustainability, governance of the commons, and the maintenance and expansion of democracy. My conversation with editor Gary Metcalf is no less engaging and thought-provoking. So without any further ado, let's turn to my interview with Gary Metcalf. Gary Metcalf, welcome to New Books in Systems and Cybernetics, and thanks so much for making the time to join us.
Thanks, Tom. I'm glad to be on.
So the first thing we do on this channel, as we do on most of the channels on the New Books Network, is to start by asking you a question about your own intellectual academic biography, so to speak, and tell us a little bit about your journey and up to and including the present time, and tell us how it unfolded and led you to a connection and interest and engagement with the whole field of systems and design, for that matter.
So basically, my career, I guess, has broken down into pretty much three sections. My first career was as a family therapist working in runaway shelters with teenagers and their families. And that was an interesting experience because it was really all about trying to understand how people worked. But one of the insights that came from that, now my training was actually in a systems-oriented family approach. So I had a lot of the concepts, but none of the theoretical background that really explained why they approached things the way they did. So the practical learning was just that adolescence simply cannot be understood in isolation. You just can't work with a teenager without understanding their family and their friends and their school and everything that creates the whole milieu, that forms their worlds. I did that for 8 or 9 years and then decided to make a shift and ended up in major corporations. So I worked for 2 different Fortune 50 corporations, managing actually employee assistance and health promotion and similar kind of programs. So the focus there really was on the intersection between people as humans and family members and people as executives and employees. A lot of the same principles applied. It was just a higher level of understanding how people functioned and operated and lived within systems. My third career really started at the end of my corporate career. So in 1995, I started a PhD while I was still at the corporation. Now, the second corporation I worked for had been through three major reorganizations, trying to basically reestablish itself and do all the things that corporations do when they're trying to get more profitable or, you know, try to make a shift to become more functional. So I started on my PhD and landed at Saybrook, where I met Bela Banathy, whose work was in social systems design. Bela really became my mentor in a number of ways, introducing me not only to systems concepts, which was just opening a new world to me. All of a sudden, there was a language and there were ideas and theories that explained all the stuff I had been working on, but really didn't have a foundation for prior to that. Bela also introduced me to systems organizations, both the ISSS and the IFSR, which led me into working with those organizations as they continue to support and develop the ideas and the theories and the research. And obviously, you know, Bela's introduction through his own work was to the concept of social systems design. So it was from there that I began to work on and gain more interest and more understanding and expertise about both the intersection of systems in a theoretical way and the application of systems to social spheres and the design and how we might intentionally affect those.
Great. And did you end up teaching at Saybrook? Yeah.
I've been actually teaching at Saybrook in varying capacities since 2003. And at other universities as well. So it's been a combination of teaching, research, consulting, both, you know, just a kind of a constant cycle of learning and application.
In choosing to pursue this publication with Springer, Social Systems and Design, what was the need that you were responding to as you sort of surveyed the literature and you decided to approach an edited volume such as this? What was the guiding vision or the what you were responding to think this is a volume that the literature needs right now?
Well, in truth, Tom, it's probably an extension of my own dissertation work in my PhD. Mm. You know, and even though it was probably an unfinished struggle more than a true resolution, it was my attempt to try to get at sort of the fundamental principles. I mean, for me, the question was, so if we actually can consciously design the systems, you know, the social structures in which we live, well, how do we do that? What do we work with? You know, there's the concepts of, well, you know, we can envision and we can govern, we can do the things that happen once you've got a structure in place. But if you're truly going to design from the ground up, what are you working with? What does it mean to design and then create a social system? So this volume was my attempt to bring together a variety of different theorists from different perspectives and backgrounds, some historical, some more theoretical, some more specifically applied, to try to bring sort of that bridge between those worlds together to at least start that some kind of discussion and exploration about how do you actually design in a social system world.
Mm-hmm. And can you say just a little bit more about how you went around choosing or soliciting the contributors to the volume?
Well, that's always, it's always an interesting confluence of the ideal and the reality. Mm-hmm. So, you know, in an ideal world, it probably would have been a larger volume, more representative of other theorists and practitioners and, you know, a broader range of people who might identify themselves specifically with design within social systems. The reality is you only end up with the contributors that you can get at a point in time. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, it's it always ends up being maybe a little bit different than you envisioned at the beginning. But when it was all said and done, as I've been reflecting back on the book this week, it really is, I think, a good range and confluence of different ideas, different people who've come from different backgrounds, working with different theories and theorists, and how they've applied and how they've thought about and how they've approached the central topic, but all come at and gone to varying places in the way that they use that.
Mm-hmm. And so some of these things you say, that the unfinished struggle or the things you were wrestling with, you spell out in the first chapter, which is of course the one you authored, and you seem to be asking, you know, how do we derive the first principles for human social systems? How do we arrive at first principles, governing principles for systems design? And you're bringing together thinkers that brought systems theory to social systems. And so as you've been reflecting on the book this week, sort of getting ready to have this talk together, where are you on that question of the first principles for social systems? Are there some that surface in this book or some that are continuing to percolate for you, or where do you stand on that now?
Well, there's a small number of issues that really kind of sent me in the direction of thinking about this, you know, at the time the book was developing and continuing on now. One is trying to understand the nature of different kinds of systems. For instance, there's an assumption, you know, if you talk with people who kind of come from a perspective of traditional psychology, for instance, you know, there's kind of an assumption that groups of people are just collections of individuals. And you can pretty much understand if you just get down to the basics of individuals, and then you add those up and you end up with a collective. Mm. When you understand and have worked in and around, you know, any kind of real collective, a group, an organization of whatever kind, if you take just a half step back, you can see pretty soon that there are characteristics of the systems themselves that really aren't defined by or actually they aren't just an addition of the individuals involved. Mm-hmm. So that really leads to questions about those first principles. If you're going to actually design something that is an ongoing surviving system that isn't simply a matter of, you know, some kind of a fixed collective of the individuals, what are you dealing with? You know, it's a lot of things in terms of what people might describe. It's a connection of communication. You know, it's probably belief systems, it's culture, it's a lot of things. And I don't know that I have arrived at any kind of a final answer, but, you know, I feel like I'm getting closer to an understanding about where some of those distinctions actually are. The contrast in the chapter, I guess, is with some of the challenges of the fact that people actually are creating systems. You know, one of the examples is things like nation building. So, you know, the assumption is that you can go in and, you know, in the most extreme circumstances, you take a military in, you remove an existing government, and then somehow something emerges, which is hopefully better. You know, that's, I guess, kind of like by analogy, going in with a lot of weed killer into a field, taking out everything you don't like and assuming that you're going to have a garden grow. You know, there's something that has to happen to create the better, that there has to be what creates that collective identity, the collective ongoing relationships, what it is that is functional between people that allows them to continue to basically to live together as an ongoing system.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned, this takes us nicely to the idea of the importance of stakeholders and their participation, which is a recurring theme across the many chapters in the book, and that you reference your great mentor, Bela Banathy, and also the work of Nigel Cross and others. Can you say a little bit about that? Because it goes beyond simply, it's nice to include people. Do you know what I mean? It's like, isn't it a nice idea to get everyone's? It's beyond that. It has to do with the possibilities for success and robustness and everything else in terms of systems. So can you say a little bit about stakeholders and participation and why it surfaces so strongly throughout the book?
Well, from Bela's foundations, Bela was a tremendous believer in humans and in human nature. He really fundamentally believed that people not only had a right, but also had a responsibility to contribute to the systems they lived in. And he believed in both sides of that. Now, that brings a lot of implications, though. So, you know, to say that, you know, there's some kind of an idealized democratic principle that everyone should have a voice and be involved is fine. It gets real messy when you start actually putting that into application. You know, the reality is there are stakeholders that have bigger voices or more power or more economic wealth to contribute, or, you know, whatever those variables are. But to assume that you can somehow have a functioning social system on a long-term basis that does not somehow honor and include the people involved is, I think, long term, just kind of naive. You know, it can happen for a time, but you know, I would propose that maybe an example would be this. You know, the colonization of countries and continents that have happened historically. You know, to go in and impose a structure on people that's completely foreign to their understanding, their way of being, you know, their daily social existence. You can do that, but the cost of imposing that structure on a long-term basis usually becomes completely unsustainable. You know, if there's not some kind of a bottom-up contribution, a real living into the system itself by the people who are a part of it, then you're really ultimately bound for failure.
Yes, and many of the authors in this book give us a lot of really scientific and empirical explanations of that of the mechanisms through which motivation is sapped and through which people, there are different types of resistance, and when there isn't this stakeholder involvement, when people are not, and this gets pointed out early on by Alexander Christakis, when people are not involved in the articulation of the problematique, right? When they're not involved in even describing what the problem is. And he starts in his chapter talking about, you know, the early days of the Club of Rome, and that this, he points to what he thinks is sort of a flaw in that famous report, is that it was a certain group of people were even in the ones defining the problem, let alone what actions should be taken. And there wasn't really wide input from different types of stakeholders as the Club of Rome began its initial work. And so that takes us to Christakis, who's a big figure sort of looming over a lot of the book, both in his own chapter and other people that have worked with him, I think been mentored by him, and the whole role of strategic dialogic design. So can you say a bit about Christakis, his influence, and what made it attractive to you to have him so involved in this, and what you think some of the most important lessons are or things to think about from his work and the work of those who have followed in his footsteps?
I actually ran across Aleko's work when I was still a student working with Bela. And one of the things that attracted me to his work, and at that time he was still working with John Warfield, as they were beginning to put together a lot of the foundational structures of the support systems for, you know, the decision-making processes and, you know, the variations that they went through. What really struck me was that Aleko seemed to have a sense about what it took in order to help people get through the process that was a step beyond just the ideal. You know, to bring people together in a setting and assume that they have an appropriate level of expertise about the topic, that they have the skill sets to be able to articulate and collaborate with each other, that they are able to work across the differences that might be involved in especially in a widely diverse setting. Sometimes those were more ideal than practical. And Aleko had worked with John Warfield to come up with what they felt like was a pretty practical, facilitated process that brought people together that could deal with those differences, that could deal with the ideas and bring them together into some kind of a coherent picture and design by the end of their 3-day process or so. You know, having sat through a couple of the examples of those, you know, there aren't any perfect processes. You know, they all have kind of approaches and underlying philosophies and limitations. But the fact that they had thought through an awful lot of it was really encouraging to me. You know, the fact that Aleko had such a breadth of experience, starting as a theoretical physicist and ended up working in, you know, this whole realm of the identified problems by the Club of Rome and his work with Osbacon and developing a problematique and understanding, you know, I think he really worked to try to get at some of those root issues so that they could be addressed you know, again, not always perfectly, but not just ignored, mm-hmm. not just overlooked as something that was missing. And so his influence, I think, on an awful lot of the practitioners, you know, including a lot of the contributors to this book, it's been strong, but I think well-deserved, you know, in that he still continues mm-hmm. to do his work. He's, I guess, mostly retired and in Crete now, but still active, still engaged with people that are continuing the work.
Yes, and his notion that there can be a science of dialogue is compelling, and the idea that there's a kind of rigor and a kind of procedure that is hopefully not limiting and not too constraining, but you know, another theme in the book is this this balance between autonomy and homonymy, if I'm pronouncing that correctly. Between the individual's autonomous nature and also coming back to the collective, and that trying to find this delicate science of trying to balance those right. two impulses.
Yeah. That work actually goes back to Andras Angiol, who was a psychiatrist in the 40s, that talked about his distinction was between autonomy and heteronomy, which was that that influence of the individual balanced against the influence of the collective. And so you can see this, you know, and as he stated, you know, it's never an absolute either or. It's always a balance between. So, you know, you can look at different countries. In the US, we tremendously value independence, individualism, and we have governance structures that kind of reflect that. In other countries, you know, and I think interestingly right now, probably increasing numbers, where the heteronomy, the, you know, the larger social sphere or governance structures are tremendously overwhelming. The individual choices and an expression of self in a lot of other places. So, you know, it's not necessarily a one is always better than the other. I think there's a functional aspect, but, you know, to just understand that they're always present, that you have to balance those. You really can't ignore either one. And they always will not only influence each other, they actually are co-creational.
So as Christakis develops his work, he comes up with a lot of, with his foundational axioms for dialogic design science, which we won't go through all of them now, but they're really fascinating as a way to structure the process of this kind of stakeholder engagement. And this idea that new, what he calls new geographies of languaging, making possible the constructions of new kinds of distinctions, and that literally new types of ontological entities become visible. So you can spot something in the nature of a pattern or something that's got some causal efficacy going on. And there's something that he identifies called the erroneous priorities effect. Can you tell us anything about that particular?
I'm trying to remember who Aleko drew from a number of the collaborators he was working with, and he ends up in a, you know, with a collection of what he, you know, I think he and the collaborators tried to establish as sort of a, not a system of laws, but a system of principles that really that are sometimes are identified as kind of pressure points. When you're doing this work, sometimes they're more necessary things that you just have to pay attention to, because, you know, they're things that are either critical points that get developed in the process, or they are important pieces that, if they get overlooked, they become really important oversights, if you will. And I'm trying to remember which of.
Well, the erroneous, what I remember about this one in particular, and I know I'm putting you on the spot because right. you didn't write all these chapters, but so yeah. I just thought I'd toss that one out and see, but it's one that stuck with me because it's fascinating to me to discover that, that dotmocracy, this whole dotmocracy thing is quite popular these days in terms of, well, let's give people the little sticky dots and everyone will vote on what are the priorities. But they in the work they've done, and this is this idea of trying to make a science of dialogic design, it seems to me, they've done this analytical work and realized that the things that groups agree are the most, have the biggest impact in terms of what is the problem or what is the potential leverage point, rarely end up winning the vote when it comes to what should we work on. And so the voting process of the dotmocracy or any of those other kinds of voting processes are not reflecting actually what are the highest impact, highest leverage, or biggest identified problems. And so there's this mismatch. And so we put a priority on something and that it may not be the one that we think is right. The most significant.
Yeah, that all those principles really go back to the foundations that Aleko was working with John Warfield on. So when I actually sat in on a couple of the processes they had done, I mean, and, you know, John and Aleko both worked in a lot of corporate settings, interestingly. You know, they weren't just doing sort of general things, but one that I sat in on, I had reviewed some information that John had done with, I think, a major corporation and kind of watched him work through that. One that I sat in on live was actually an interesting example where the discussion was around the implementation of how you provide accommodations for students who have been identified with disabilities. Okay, so this cut across all kinds of educational systems. It was done, in sort of a regional approach to trying to help small educational programs, especially small rural settings. They were equally required to provide accommodations for individual students, even though they had minimal resources to be able to try to do that. So, the stakeholder group that was involved ranged from the school counselors to the psychologists who were outside the school system to, parents to even in some cases, the students who had been identified, school administrators. Everyone had a vested interest in trying to reach a good resolution, but needless to say, everyone also had a very different perspective on their part of what the nature of the problem was, much less how it might best be solved. So to watch them go through the process, it really was functionally, it was a pairing of choices. So they would raise the question, if you were to accomplish this, how would it affect that? And it was a couple of days of working through that with a number of facilitators who were capturing the information in a computer system that would, at the end of the time, come up with a structured representation of connections between the issues. And that's what they used to find the largest leverage points. And it was through that process that they arrived at exactly this kind of conclusion that, what people assumed would be, if you just simply took a poll and said, okay, what's the most important thing? What should we start on? Well, you're going to get a lot of opinions, but they're going to obviously come from the perspectives of the people involved. It's only when you pull those together in some kind of a collective and structured way that they found that they could actually arrive at a solution that would have the best chance of being implemented.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Well, that's fascinating. I would love to be able to sit in as you have on some of these sessions. That's fantastic. One of the next contributors is Raul Espejo, and of course, talking about Project CyberSyn, of which he was, I believe, the scientific director, I think was his official title. It's a project that's gotten a fair amount of airtime on this channel. We talked to Eden Medina about her book, and it's come up in some other discussions. But it's really interesting to see. I think this is the most rigorous critique of it I've seen, and it's by Raoul, who was an insider on it. And he talked about the need for that Cybersyn's epistemological lens needed some revision. So I'm wondering if you might say something about the role of epistemology in these kinds of group discussions. Raoul is talking about how the epistemological lens needs to include the first order sort of black box descriptions of what you see going on, and a second order observation of what he calls the inner conversations that govern the choices of the black box indices. Because of course, Cybersyn, and I refer those who are not as familiar with it to go back to find our conversation with Eden Medina, but was an attempt to create a guidance system, a control system for the Chilean economy, and this choice of indices. So the choice, this again relates, I guess, just what we were just speaking about, of what goes into the choice of what one considers to be a pertinent index to decide how the governance system is working.
Well, just a little broader perspective about this chapter. As I was thinking through what could ideally go into the book, I absolutely did not want to miss this piece, because it seemed to me that such a large scale and really potentially important application, even though I'm not sure that Stafford Beer would have identified himself as a social system designer, but this application at a country level was just too important, not to try to capture in some way. And I really, as I thought through the people that could potentially author the chapter, having Raoul do it as a person on the ground from Chile who had that perspective was just the one that seemed to be, enough different and valuable to me to try to capture all of that. So, you've got a technical system, which is, obviously not unusual in what people think about. Okay, well, let's bring in a governance system, or let's bring in a control system, or however they describe that. And often within that are embedded all kinds of assumptions, obviously. So you get to things like Peter Checklin's concept of Weltanschauung when he does soft systems methodology. Why that's important to capture? Because there are so many unstated assumptions that go into that. You can kind of start with, if it's from an engineering standpoint, we'll simply, we'll start with whatever the customer says is important. Coming with multitudes of assumptions about, the customer's knowledge, viewpoint, and, the breadth of how that's going to end up being implemented. So, a lot of the emphasis in the cybernetic world, coming from, I guess, really the 1970s on, was this concept of second order cybernetics, of understanding that you've got the functional part of what goes on in what might look like a technical system, but you've also got the overlay of the context of, not only how the system got decided and designed, as you've implied, but that it will continue to function within social systems, unless you completely turn over. And I suppose there are visions of that, of totally turning over the operation of something to some, to an artificial intelligence system. It's still, as long as there are humans around, it's embedded within human social systems at some level. They are affected by it, even if they aren't directly attempting to control it. And so this whole concept of who's involved and how the decisions get made, and how that affects what the ultimate design and creation are massively important questions, but they're ones that are also, from a project management standpoint, sometimes considered, well, that's kind of expensive, or that's going to delay, that's going to create more time. Is it worth it? We're on a project timeline, get it done. I don't think that's what went into the Cybersyn project, but I think that ultimately there probably were people on the receiving end who looked at what was involved and said, well, okay, we want to create a system to, to monitor and ultimately control. So, we'll put this into place. obviously no one anticipated at the time the political ramifications of what was going to change in the country over those 3 years.
Yeah, and something Raul mentions is the mismatch between who was making the decisions about indices, that the political structures of hierarchical systems did not change enough to match the kind of distributed types of decision making that CyberSyn and that the VSM, the viable systems model, is designed to facilitate. So the structure of the VSM is one thing, but who's deciding on indices, who's providing that information wasn't able to transcend the sort of old-fashioned hierarchical structures of the government that was trying to implement the VSM.
So I think mismatch, for a lot of people who look at the viable systems model, you know, because it is somewhat prescriptive, you know, you basically take the template and you overlay it onto the organization or the larger system that you're looking at. I'm afraid that people might have a lot of assumptions about, well, then it seems to be kind of self-evident, right? You just match the pieces to the parts of VSM, you know, and you then get a sense about what's working and what's not. I think this is just one of those examples where you have to step back and say, you know, every one of these decision points, every one of these, you know, these crucial pressure points along the process is really important. You know, it's not just going to design itself. It's not going to create itself. It's not going to fix itself.
Right. And I think he also mentions that sort of idea of saying, rather than reimagining the entire structure around the VSM, it was sort of saying, okay, well, this thing we've already got, that's kind of like system three. And that thing over here, that's kind of like system two, and sort of just shoving the existing structures into the boxes of the VSM, as opposed to saying, well, we've got to actually think wider than that. And how do we actually start rewiring
In this size of an application, you can imagine how that happens. You know, it's like, just be expedient. You know, this is good enough. Get that done. You know, we've got so much time and money. Make that one work. You know, just kind of shave off the corners and it'll fit okay.
Right. And with a government that's facing so much pressure internally, externally, who doesn't know how long it's got to try and make a difference. I mean, the fact that they attempted such a ambitious project under the kind of political and social climate is still astonishing and very easy to understand why, as you say, this was not something you wanted to miss out on.
Well, and it's exactly the challenge that, you know, is going to come up at, you know, and it shows up in some of the other chapters, but shows up most broadly just in the whole topic, I think, Tom, that you're always balancing between the ideal, you know, some concept that maybe the ideal is just a green field and you can, you know, you've got nothing but space to be able to create in. And the reality that there is always a lot of ongoing world into which you eventually have to implement this. And, you know, the space between those is really the critical place to understand.
Right. And that you're revising something that's in motion, right? The Chilean economy could not stop and take a time out while they figured out what they were going to do. It's you know, it's like laying the track down in front of the moving train, so to speak. It's ongoing. One of my favorite chapters is Peter Jones's chapter, Design Principles, where he talks about design principles for complex social systems. And he really exposes something that I hadn't thought that much about, because talking about design, and a lot of that, I guess some of it has happened since the publication of the book, but the idea of certainly this expanded sense of what design means now, and that everyone designs to some degree, and it's not just artifacts and products, but it's processes, experiences, interactions, all of these things are now, we understand them as in the purview of design. And the ideas of design and systems theory talking to each other. But in his chapter, Peter points out that actually within the literature, there isn't actually that much direct linkage of systems theory to design. They're talked about sort of side by side, but not always in a way that we can understand where exactly, or at least have some ideas of where exactly certain systems principles can get instantiated within certain design principles or design projects. He does quite an interesting literature review of that. I'm interested, and so he talks about his wanting to link generative design guidelines to systems theoretical principles rather than just enumerating them side by side, which is actually done more often.
Well, it's just, I really appreciated Peter contributing the chapter because it is in its own way kind of the anomaly. You've got not a systems theorist or practitioner approaching the concept of design. You've got a designer coming kind of from the other side of the bridge, if you will, of, you know, saying, well, here are all the formal principles of design. And he teaches design and practices it, but has, you know, really been fascinated and come into the world of systems concepts and theories as well. So, you know, he reaches the intersection just from the other side. And so his way of understanding it, where, you know, I think a lot of people who start with the systems orientation, you know, those of us, including me, I guess, who, you know, are very interested in it, but really don't have a formal background, approach a certain level of understanding about the formalities of design. But to come from the other side, to know the formalities of design as a profession and bring that to the perspective of systems is, I think, a really valuable other insight.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and he reveals how much work there is to do to really make them speak to each other to the degree, or enable them to speak to each other to the degree that would be most beneficial. There's this notion of design as a third culture, and this has come up in other conversations we've had on this channel and amongst other people I know within the cybernetics and systems communities. There was a period where there was this attempt to formulate something called design science, and to put design on a more scientific framework. And people like Cross and others, and Peter picks this up, that design as a third culture, not science, not the art and the humanities, but its own particular, a third sort of branch of knowledge or a sort of domain. Is there any reflections you have on that notion?
It's, I think it's a critical question. And I think it's one that we probably haven't come very close to really resolving as much in the systems realm as anyplace else, frankly. So there's a perspective on science that its purpose is to objectively understand nature and, you know, everything that has come about. There is, you know, if you think about the two cultures perspective of C.P. Snow, you know, there's this other side, mm-hmm. which is, you know, this large body of artistic, you know, other kinds of approaches, ways of thinking that, you know, are really more the human realm, but of innovation, creativity, you know, whatever gets included in that. Kind of the liberal arts side of the university. This design thing really is an interesting other piece because it somehow you have to assume that if design is in fact even possible, then you're talking about something that is, certainly if it's in a human realm, it's beyond just the inevitable evolution that happens in the universe. You know, so depending on your perspective about that, I mean, there's the, you know, the beliefs and cosmologies of grand design or whatever people might believe. But if you bring it down to humans and social system design, then you really get into the questions about things like free will. So to what degree can humans actually create a future that is different than something that might otherwise have just inevitably come about? Do we have the capacity to consciously create the systems that we live in or even consciously affect them? Because if we do, then you've got a range, degrees of freedom, if you will, about the world that extend beyond just the natural influences that, you know, might be typical of what's discovered in science. And so in that way, yes, it is a different realm of exploration. You know, to what degree is it somehow another realm where it's not entirely defined by any of the others? You know, you get into, you know, even questions about engineering and technology. Well, you can do the specific technology, you know, you can build, make something. But when you then think about a larger realm of, well, it's not just a something that's going to act in isolation. It's a something that's going to become a part of the ongoing biosphere and affect and become a part of evolution. Then again, it's a different question about, so what are our capabilities? What are our capacities for not only being able to do that, but being able to do that with some kind of a moral or ethical lens?
Mm-hmm. Well, it's beautifully said, and I think that really articulates what's at the crux of this entire book and this entire project as I've read it. Speaking of our capabilities, a number of the later chapters, and some in very specific ways, get into this idea of new models of democracy, new models of governance. And as one author even goes as far as to say that, you know, representative democracy is just outdated the way we do it. We need to move on. And so these ideas of a more direct democracy, more consultative democracy, you've got Tom Flanagan and the 21st Century Agoras group, who are interested in how do you start, I mean, it sounds like Aleko and others, you know, are already doing consultations with larger groups of people than we could imagine in the past, hundreds, thousands of people. But this idea of still trying to scale it up even further to even to the size of a nation state or beyond, given that, you know, the globalization is, you know, making us question whether the nation state is even the correct place to look for levers of governance. But this idea, can we use the current technologies or the developing technologies to leverage up a more direct and inclusive kind of democracy? Someone later in the book, I wish I could remember who it was, says, rather than saying to go to discussion-centric rather than vote-centric. And rather than say, you get to vote every 5 years, no, you get to actually get involved in debate and discussion in an ongoing way. And so, but of course, the idea of, you know, thinking of the law of requisite variety, I mean, that having that kind of influx of variety of opinion, et cetera, can you reflect on some of the contributions that address this issue and maybe add some of your own thoughts about the feasibility, desirability, et cetera, of trying to use these platforms, these amazing social platforms of the internet, et cetera, to actually scale up and create a new model of democratic governance?
Well, needless to say, Tom, these are massive challenges, even a concept before you begin to think about what they would mean in any kind of application. But they're really, really important questions. So, you know, it's easy to begin with maybe an overly simplistic or even naive perspective that, you know, it should just all be absolute pure democracy. We've got technology now, so, you know, basically every important question that comes up, you know, people just vote on Twitter and, you know, you collect them all and you've got an opinion, you've got a decision. You can see how that might not be the most ideal. So there's some balance between people's connectedness to a particular issue, people's sense of expertise about particular things. There's some kind of a middle balance between, you know, the everybody being represented in a way that is moral, ethical, even practical, and the process of decision making, you know, about what kinds of issues, in what timelines, and at what scale. So, you know, it would be pretty easy to say, well, you know, if you look around, the current systems probably are pretty insufficient at this point relative to what could be. But what the next step is, you know, that's a different kind of question. So the technology certainly allows a lot more people to be more informed and to be more interactive about issues. How to now step on the other side and look at the human level to determine, you know, so what is the most effective way, efficient, productive, to actually create the decisions that become then those points of change in the social systems? That's a part that I don't know we've explored that much. So, you know, you get mm-hmm. a sense, certainly there's a strong, strong ethical perspective by most of the authors in this book that I don't disagree with, that people do have a right to be involved. There really is a strong sense of the rights of individuals globally. To step outside the book, and some work I've actually been getting into really currently is looking at some other work on decision making. And one of the research studies that I've actually been working on just in the last week is looking at this question of decision making. And basically what it says is that there's a balance that as long as it's a simple problem, then having more opinions involved is likely to get you to a better answer, sort of the wisdom of crowds. Okay. So if you've got a fairly simple problem and you take a whole lot of opinions, you know, you can probably get to something that is going to be a pretty reasonable answer rather than, for instance, just taking, you know, the loudest opinion. That begins to flip when you get to more complex problems. And with more complex problems, simply having a lot more opinions isn't necessarily helpful. You really do need to rely in that case on better expertise. And finding that expertise, it's not necessarily just, you know, a one or two experts, and it's not just a, you know, relying on the best or loudest. It still involves, in you know, including more opinions, but the more complex the issue, it seems that a smaller number of people with higher expertise probably is a better way to approach that. Now, again, that's one, you know, study or small set of studies that is leading in that direction. Mm-hmm. But I think it's that kind of work that is going to be really helpful in terms of moving towards a next way of beginning to sort out, you know, if you're not going to try to make a pure democracy around the globe, then what do you do? You know, what's the way we begin to approach this? And it's that kind of research, I think, that we're going to have to keep working on and relying on to take us to the next steps.
Mm-hmm. And it's interesting, this loops back to some of the early chapters in the book we've already spoken about, because as early as CyberSyn, Stafford Beer and his team had developed this algedonic meter where there was going to be some kind of direct feedback to the government, not on an issue-by-issue basis. It was as simple as, you know, happy, right, not happy, and the setting. But there was this desire to somehow have real-time feedback to the government, even you know, in this project in the early 70s. And then I think also about the strategic, the dialogic design, the science of dialogic design that Christakis and colleagues have done, where also thinking about requisite variety, that they are at least trying to identify the widest number of types of stakeholder, and knowing that you can't have every single person in the room, that there is still a sort of benchmark of variety that you have to achieve, that if there is a constituency that you have not identified, or you try and identify those constituencies to make sure that there is representation from every category of stakeholder, for lack of a better term, that you're still attenuating variety to some degree, but hopefully having the requisite variety that the representation is ethical and also most effective.
If you miss an important issue of relevance, you know that it's going to be, you know, whatever the solution or decision is going to be somewhat imperfect. You know, somehow you have to account for as much as possible the important and relevant factors that affect a particular issue or system. You know, is there a perfect way of doing that? Not that I've seen yet. You know, Wes Churchman talked about kind of a spectrum of different ways ultimately of sweeping in, you know, the attempt to try to make sure that as much as possible, all relevant information had been included or accounted for in some way. How you go about that, you know, again, not simple. But I think it's not something to just sort of generalize and say, oh, yeah, well, you know, we should be inclusive as much as possible and then make the best of it. I think we're going to have to get to some next steps of being a lot clearer. So what's really involved in this particular issue? What do we need to include? How do we foresee what might be the possible outcomes, whether that's, you know, running some scenario planning in advance, whether it's, you know, making sure that you've got pretty diverse teams of experts to be able to help think through even before you begin. You know, are there things we may have missed? Are there relevant factors that, you know, anybody can foresee? And maybe you do a first round and, you know, test it out before you make the decision process, just to make sure that we're starting to account for an awful lot of these factors. You know, the more complex the world gets, the more important that becomes.
Mm-hmm. Well, these are definitely the sticky and very, very challenging questions that this work points to, and that, as you say, we need to keep chipping away at. So are there any particular contributions or themes in the book that we haven't touched on yet that as we move towards the close of our time to talk, is there any that you would like to comment on or draw our attention to that we haven't spoken about yet?
Maybe just to point to the last couple of chapters, the last two, simply because they are different contributors kind of outside of the realm of people that had, you know, worked with each other or, you know, particularly with Aleco and some of those foundations.
Right. So, right. We get the open systems
so
perspective.
Marilyn Emery, who is the widow of Fred Emery, of, you know, Emery and Trist and the Tavistock kind of work. You know, Marilyn has carried on that work through her own theory building and application. And so her chapter comes across as I think, an interesting contrast in a lot of ways. You know, it's very ideal. But it is also very much in the cultural perspective of Australia. And so her proposal, while, you know, the reaction of a few people that I had talked to or heard from, for instance, the US, you know, is like, really? But yeah, I think from her perspective, really, you know, when she talks about, you know, the completely self-governing work groups, Is that a real possibility? Well, the truth is, it's actually been tried in places which haven't been that well publicized. And to the degree that they could be protected, it was actually more functional than what people might have expected. You know, can people truly get more involved than what they typically find themselves now? I think very possibly, you know, and her work really points to that. You know, to the degree that people, I think, have become so accustomed to simply going to a workplace and having little of any say about any of the processes they're involved in. They pretty much, you know, go in, plug in, get the work done, and leave. You know, this idea that somehow they can be more of a participant and a decision maker, even at a very low level, is so foreign that it's really kind of hard to even have that discussion. So what she proposes is pretty ideal, but I think not really outside the realm of reason. The balance of that is Doug Walton's chapter. And, you know, Doug had been a senior change person inside of Cisco and then some other places more recently. But, you know, his is, I think, that practical calibration of, you know, having also been a student of Bela's, to look at idealized systems design and have to interpret that to an approach or a way that you could implement that inside of a US-based corporation. You know, it's not just a simple translation. It does take some real adaptation, but it's also absolutely possible. You know, it's possible to work from the principles, even if you don't go in and try to teach all the theories. It's possible to do the implementation and to get people involved without necessarily having to, you know, bring them up to a PhD level of understanding about, you know, the systemic principles and theories.
Right. Well, thank you for that. I think it was very important to draw attention to those two chapters. And Marilyn Emery's chapter is, like you say, there is an ideal nature to it, but it is very thoughtful in terms of the two different types of work cultures that you're talking about, where the prescribed work culture and then this idea of teams that self-organize. And I think we see a lot more of those around us these days than I think, as you say, are reported. And when they're bound together by, when that autonomy is given and that our autonomy is recognized, the responsibility that the members of the team start to take towards one another is a very powerful force. And that the ways that the groups create and self-assign which part of the work gets done by whom, I think we see more and more of that around us all the time.
Well, it really gets back to, I think, some of Bela's fundamental beliefs, where when you begin to marry the right to participate in design with the responsibility to participate, they are self-reinforcing.
Right. Oh, I think that's a perfect note to draw our discussion to a close. And I'll move to our last question. You've already mentioned a little bit. You've alluded to some work you're doing on decision-making processes. But is there anything you can tell us about projects you're working on now and what we might look forward to from you in the future?
Well, projects in terms of additional publications, I'm actually working again with Jim Kojima, who initiated this Translational System Science series. And hopefully within the next year, we'll have a reference book out from Springer, the Handbook of System Sciences, which will be some number of chapters, probably 30 plus chapters, by a broader range of contributors to try to create a basic reference book, really for large universities. That's where the Springer reference books are likely to end up. So people that may not have an orientation, but at least can get an introduction, hopefully within, the sphere of their own fields and professions, but then also be exposed to the larger realm across the entire spectrum of what's covered in the handbook. In application, it's interesting because I find myself, whether it's intentional or not, often drawn to things like small projects in the very small town where I live in Appalachia, where a local organization is trying to go through its own changes, and I have had now a few decades of experience of thinking about change and thinking about the ways it happens and the theories, and to walk into a small organization that's trying to go through some fundamental changes in a small community. It is still all the same hard work. It doesn't happen simply just because you know more of the theories. It's really helping people grasp with their situation and some concept of what can be changed and how they go about it.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much for your time, Gary. We look forward to the Systems Handbook very much, and hopefully we'll be able to talk to you and maybe some of the other contributors as it comes along. And yes, that Translational Science series is full of amazing titles. I think we've done at least one other of them on this show, and I've got a couple of coming up. So that series is a very rich place for systems and cybernetics thinking and great writing and fodder for our show, of course. Thank you so much, Gary. We look forward to talking to you again. Thank you so much for taking the time to be with us. We've been talking to Gary Metcalf about his edited book, Social Systems and Design, out from Springer, here on New Books in Systems and Cybernetics, a podcast channel of the New Books Network. We'll talk to you again soon.